The book of Daniel is very important to us in terms of understanding a general progression of prophecy. It's in this book that we have multiple prophecies and their interpretations that point out that there were going to be four major empires that would rule and govern the area of the Middle East and a good portion of the world, in fact. And they're described as the Chaldean or Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greco-Macedonian Empire, and the Roman Empire, with that last empire having multiple reincarnations in that sense, or additional times at which it became had a revival throughout the centuries. Now, that particular one would dominate Europe and the area around the Middle East and the Mediterranean Sea, and have one final revival taking place right before the return of Jesus Christ. Now, of course, the book of Revelation adds more detail that the book of Daniel doesn't give us about what's going on in those four empires. But most of the book is written, the book of Daniel, that is written as a historical narrative with a mix of dialogue. We hear dialogue between the king, between Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and between Daniel and various ones. But chapter 4 is rather interesting. It's a rather interesting oddity. I'm going to turn to Daniel chapter 4. It's written as a royal proclamation by King Nebuchadnezzar. And it's written in Aramaic, or I should say Aramaic, which was the diplomatic language of the time. In fact, if you do a little study on the book of Daniel, you'll find that chapters 2 through 7 are all written in Aramaic. The rest of the book's in Hebrew, but those chapters are in Aramaic. I don't want to get bogged down in those details, but this particular chapter I'd like to take a look at. Daniel chapter 4, if we begin in verse 1, it starts with the statement, Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. This is kind of a standard greeting. If you read commentaries, they'll say in the days of the Persian Empire, this was sort of the way they would begin their letters or their formal proclamations. Now, one thing they point out, and this is interesting to me, most of the time when they begin a letter, especially a proclamation by a king, there's all kind of flowery language about how great the king is and how wonderful he is, the great, omnipotent, or all-powerful, or a great ruler, King Nebuchadnezzar. This is very plain vanilla, isn't it? Nebuchadnezzar, the king, period. Why? Well, if you look at what this chapter describes, you know what he went through. For 7 years, he lived as not a person, not a human, but as an animal. And so commentators say, well, he was in a rather humble state of mind when he wrote this, not his normal state of mind. Anyway, he addresses it to everybody. Verse 2, he says, I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are his signs and how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions in my head troubled me. Now, again, I won't read through the rest of this, but like I said, this lack of flowery, almost braggadocio language about the king seems to be an indication that he wrote it. Now, you read a few commentators and say, well, he couldn't have written it if he didn't give all this flowery stuff. But again, remember what he's been through. If we look at the rest of the chapter, I think it tells us, yeah, he was the writer. Kind of depends on your attitude and your perspective, doesn't it? If you want to disprove the book of Daniel, you'll look at it one way. If you want to help support and prove it, you'll kind of view it from a different perspective. It's interesting the way the commentators do that. Again, I won't read the rest of the chapter, but here's the quick summary. Nebuchadnezzar had this dream about a huge tree. He told it to the wise men. They couldn't give an explanation that it was satisfied him. Daniel was called eventually. The king explained the dream in verses 10 through 17. God revealed it to Daniel. Daniel was a bit perplexed when he heard it. He didn't really want to explain it to the king, but the king insisted. And he said, the king, you king, you're that huge tree that's grown great, and the power reaches to the end of the earth, but God's going to strike you down. and you're going to live not as a human, but among the animals. For 7 years to teach you that God's rule is sovereign, that he really is in control of everything that goes on. He's even responsible for you being able to come to power, king. That's something the king hadn't thought about. And he's going to teach you a lesson in that. Now, notice Daniel's advice in verses 26 and 27. It says, and inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you, after you come to know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. Maybe it won't happen. Essentially, the response or his advice to the king is repent. Repent. Stop doing what you've been doing. But the next few verses shows that a year later, the king was in his palace boasting about his greatness, and he was struck down to live as an animal, eating grass and living out in the wild. God gave him back his understanding, and skip down to the end of the book, end of the chapter, rather. Verse 36, we can start there. It says, at the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth, and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. Finally, the king got the message, didn't he? Prior to this, there wasn't much humility in Nebuchadnezzar. Instead of him being grateful and showing gratitude to God for giving him the rule over his vast empire, he was boastful. He was proud. He was arrogant. It took this horrifying experience to give him a different attitude. Now, that attitude didn't last. At least it lasted for a while. But he wrote this decree to remind himself, maybe, but to share it with everyone in his kingdom, what he had gone through. If you think about this, isn't the king's attitude, including this lack of appreciation for what he had been given, isn't that somewhat similar to what we're warned about by the Apostle Paul, about the end times, the way people are going to be in the end times? As we approach our national day of giving thanks to God for his incredible blessings that he has poured out on this nation and that we get to be the beneficiaries of, what do we learn from this attitude? What do we learn from Nebuchadnezzar? And what can we do to avoid the same attitude he had of ingratitude? You know, this week's LHT Weekly Newsletter, when it came yesterday, I noticed the lead article was about ingratitude, and they chose the example of King Nebuchadnezzar. I thought, well, I need to change my sermon. Nah, I don't want to change my sermon. I mean, we can still talk about the same thing. But they chose this example as well as talking about Paul's warnings about end time attitude. Since I mentioned it, let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 3 and look at some of the characteristics that we're warned against. And as we read through 2 Timothy 3, I'm going to ask you to think about Nebuchadnezzar, not after he was humbled, but the prideful, boastful King Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler before God humbled him, the wealthy, powerful, but cruel and evil king. I say evil because Expositor's Bible Commentary says that Jews later on gave him a Hebrew nickname. Literally, when you translate the Hebrew nickname, it means the wicked. The wicked. That was the way the Jews viewed King Nebuchadnezzar. 2 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, says this, but know this, that in the last times perilous, margin says you can translate this times of stress, but perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. So where do you think King Nebuchadnezzar might have matched up with that list of descriptors? I would say he probably matched up with quite a few of them. So it isn't that these are new things that have never been known to human beings in the end times, but Paul, God, through Paul, is warning us that, you know, this is going to become more and more prevalent in the end times as we draw close to the return of Jesus Christ. I mean, we could go down the list. Self-love, boaster, proud, unthankful, holy, brutal. Lots of things I think would tie in here. Wait a minute. You notice what God snuck in here, though? In the midst of all this bad-sounding stuff, he put the little word unthankful. If we look at all this evil stuff that he's describing, how does unthankful? It seems kind of a little more innocuous, doesn't it? Okay, so I'm not real thankful. That doesn't make me an evil, brutal, cruel lover of myself and boaster, does it? Well, God doesn't categorize these in any way. He just says these are all evil things that are going to happen. Unthankful. Again, what's that word doing in this list of evils? Let me take you to Romans chapter 1. In Romans chapter 1, Paul is writing what many commentators have recognized as kind of a doctrinal thesis, going over many of the basic doctrines of the church in the first 8 chapters. And in chapter 1, he is excoriating the Romans, the Gentiles, for their approach to God and their lack of recognition of God. Won't read much of this, but let's pick it up in verse 18. He says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them," or to them, "for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. These things Paul was inspired to write evoke God's wrath. They evoke his anger. God's perturbed at these types of things. You know, he describes himself as gracious, merciful, long-suffering, patient. Certainly that's what he is to those who try to obey him and follow him. But to those who ignore him and know better, he's describes himself as pretty powerful. So what's the problem here with unthankful? Well, they know God exists, is what Paul is saying, but they deny him. And in denying him, they refuse to give him glory. They refuse to give him any credit for the things that they've been able to accomplish as Gentiles in the Roman Empire, leaders in particular, but just people who are living in the Roman Empire. They fail to give God glory and praise. They won't give him glory or any kind of credit for the good things that happened to them. And they claim that it's all about them. I did this. I did that. I accomplished this thing. I caused this great blessing, this great good thing to happen to me. So therefore, they're not thankful. They're not thankful. They believe they earned and they deserve the good things that happened in their life. They don't give the credit to God. The result of that is the darkening of their hearts, which have now become foolish for denying God and claiming that they are the source of their own good. They're the source of their own blessings. So this is why God takes such umbrage at this. You see how that progression goes? When you deny God and you begin looking to yourself as the source of all of your benefits and all of your good things, in one sense, you're disparaging God. A person gets something good, maybe success in a task, maybe money, maybe recognition, maybe praise, and their mind leads them down the path of grandizing themselves instead of giving blessings to God. Remember, God warned ancient Israel about taking that path of thought before they went into the promised land, back in the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 8. Let's go there and notice that this same progression. Instead of thinking, hey, it's about time, I deserve that, In fact, I deserved it a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. They should have been giving me this, or, you know, or I should have seen this or had this or gotten this a long time ago. God warned them. He said, you're about to go into the promised land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. Out of the hills, you're going to dig precious metals, precious things. A land loaded with natural resources, just like natural resources, like the land we're blessed to live in. And he said, be careful. When things start going well, be careful. Let's pick it up in verse 6. Therefore, he says, this is Deuteronomy 8, verse 6, therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills. A land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey. A land in which you shall eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing. A land whose stones are iron, out of whose hills you'll dig copper. Again, just loaded with natural resources. That's what I'm bringing you into. That's what I'm going to give to you. Imagine how that sounded to them, marching around the desert for, I don't know, at this time, 30-some-odd years prior to the 40 years of wandering. They were getting toward the tail end of that. They saw sand, rocks, sand, mountains, sand, occasional little oasis, and sand. Probably got pretty boring seeing all the sand. And God describes this land with water, with food, with abundance of natural resources. It must have sounded like a paradise, a land of affluence. But look at verse 10. We begin here. And when you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he's given you. Give the credit to God, he's saying. Beware. That's a word that says, whoa, look, stop. Pay attention to this. Got to be careful about this, folks. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you've eaten and are full, and you've built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock and fed you in the wilderness with manna, which you're... Is this a sentence by Paul? I mean, this sentence goes on and on and on, doesn't it? On and on of what he did. Fed you in the wilderness, verse 16, picking you up again, with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and he might test you and do you good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. Wow, what a horrible scenario. God brings them in, does incredible miracles to give them this beautiful land full of natural resources, and they start claiming they're responsible for their success. They forget God. They don't give him credit. They look to themselves. See the condemnation of the Roman world in Romans 1? It's the same thing, isn't it? It's the same thing. All of these are a part of pride, arrogance, futile thinking, darkened hearts, people who reject God, people who don't give praise to God. People who have become fools. Those are God's words. They've become fools because they don't give him the credit. Now, these are probably where many of the ancient writers, these kinds of passages, where many writers got their ideas about ingratitude being such a terrible evil. Many ancient writers listed it as a terrible vice. I'll give you a couple of quick quotes. This one is from Immanuel Kant, an 18th century Prussian philosopher. He said, ingratitude is the essence of vileness. Now, of course, we think in terms of gratitude toward God. That's the warning here in Deuteronomy 8. That was a warning in Romans chapter 1. But just in general, Immanuel Kant is saying ingratitude is the essence of vileness. Seneca, a Roman philosopher, wrote this, greed's worst point is its ingratitude. Greed's worst point is its ingratitude. When you're greedy and you're constantly looking for more and more, you're not really grateful for what you have. Seems to be what he's describing as a common situation. Here's another quote. This was Joseph Hall, a 17th century English bishop. He said this, There be three usual causes of ingratitude upon a benefit received: envy, pride, and covetousness. Envy, looking more at others' benefits than our own; pride, looking more at ourselves than at the benefit; and covetousness, looking more at what we would have than what we do have. Looking more at what we could have. Looking more at what someone else has and wishing we had that as well, rather than looking at what we have. Interesting, as I read through those, Seneca and Joseph Hall both link ingratitude to greed, envy, pride, and covetousness. Now those are all mental. Those are all things that happen in our mind. They're attitudes. They're not actions per se. They're spiritual attributes, characteristics, or attitudes that are condemned in the Bible. And those seem to be obvious evils that are in the progression of Romans 1 and the warning of this progression here in Deuteronomy chapter 8. So they're very negative. Ingratitude is seen as a very negative thing. It's a progressive spiral that takes someone further and further away from God and further away from wisdom. Now, what do we gain from showing gratitude, and how do we build that attitude of gratitude? I'd like to look at a couple of passages instructing us to be grateful. We could say thankful. We could say appreciative. We could use any number of words, but instructions about being grateful and thankful to God. There are a lot we could pick from. I think doing a quick word search and all the cognates of thank and thanks and appreciation and those things are over 140 or somewhere in that neighborhood. Won't read them all. Be very selective. I'm going to read a few of them. I want to go to the Old Testament for the first one. It's in Psalm 50. In Psalm 50, let's turn to that one. You know, this idea of looking at a progression of where our thought processes tend to go got me to thinking about several of these passages. And if we look at Psalm 50, beginning in verse 13, we see in a sense a kind of progression that's being described here. Psalm 50, beginning in verse 13, the heading says this is a psalm of Asaph. But picking it up in verse 13, this is in a sense God speaking. I guess I could start in verse 12. He says, "If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and in all its fullness." And the word mine is capitalized with capital M, so this is, in a sense, quoting God or saying this could be God speaking. Verse 13, "Will I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Offer to God thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you and you shall glorify me." Take a look at the progression that's described here. He says, give thanks to God, give your appreciation to God, show your gratitude to God. And when you do that, when you have that thankful heart, you're in that practice of expressing your gratitude to God, then it shows his willingness to intervene and help us in times of trouble. There's a link between the two. That if we are showing our gratitude to God, expressing that, he's willing to help us in times of trouble. Now, let's back up a step from this. What does that say about when we should be giving God thanks or be showing gratitude? Only when things get really bad? Now, if we wait till then, who's going to say he's going to step in for us? When things are good, when we need to be giving him thanks. Then when things are bad, he says, yeah, I'll step in, I'll help you. See, so often people today, unfortunately, often don't call on God until things are really bad, and then they call on God. I think we realize in the Church of God, we're aware of this. We call on God all the time. We should have that communication, regular communication with God. And we should be thankful to God. We should express our gratitude to him continually. Especially when things are going well. So that we're not like ancient Israel and we're not like the Gentiles described in Romans 1. I want to link this with Ephesians 5. Let's turn to a passage in the New Testament, something that the Apostle Paul wrote. Ephesians chapter 5. And we'll begin in verse 18. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 18. He says, "And do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation." I think there's another way of translating that. I'll get to that in a minute. But do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your hearts to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. So Paul is saying here, we should always give thanks to God for everything. We ought to constantly be giving Him thanks and showing our appreciation and gratitude to Him. Now, does that mean if something terrible happens, you know, my truck just blows up, I give God thanks for that? Well, I don't think that's what he's saying. Yes, we face difficulties and we face problems, but again, his point is give thanks all the time, not just when you have trouble, then try to call on him, and you haven't given him any appreciation or to show any gratitude for the things that he's done to you prior to that. He's actually drawing a comparison here, if you look at this. It starts in verse 18. He's drawing a comparison. I looked this up in a couple of other translations, and the English Standard Version says it this way. It says, "Do not get drunk with wine, for that is debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit." Now, drunkenness was all too common in the ancient world, a very common problem. And it's a serious temptation to Christians, has been all through the centuries. It's been a challenge for Christians as well. There's a website I was looking for some statistics, and alcohol.org says about 17% of men and 8% of women in the United States, the U.S. population, will meet the criteria for alcoholism at some point in their life, an emotional or physical dependence on alcohol. That's a pretty high percentage of people. If we assume we have 80, 90 people here, well, let's just pick 80. It's an easy number to divide in two. You know, that's 80 people, say maybe half men, half women. 17% of 40 ends up being about 7 men and about 3 women. So about 10 people in a group this size in the general population of the United States would at some point in their life meet that criteria of the definition of alcoholism. Now, hopefully that's not the case in our group, but it's certainly a common thing in our world and a common thing in our country. So it's something we, as Christians, need to constantly be thinking about. I don't want to be in this category. God says, do not be drunk with wine. But the focus here is not really on alcoholism. The focus here is on, okay, here's what you really need to be doing. You need to be filled with another spirit, not the spirits of alcohol, but the Spirit of God, God's Holy Spirit. That's his focus. He says to draw on that invigorating power of God's Spirit. That's what we need to be focused on, and that's what we need to be filled with. The verb there is in the present tense, meaning keep on being filled with the Holy Spirit. Keep it active in your life. Keep drawing on God's Spirit to have that involved in all that you do. And then beginning in verse 19, he lists 4 outlets for the outcome of God's Spirit being active in our lives. And they all involve praising God, whether it's in the formal setting here of church services or in a private setting. And he says that's going to lead to us, or in a sense be linked to us, giving praise and thanks to God. Here's what Expositor Bible Commentary says about verse 20, where he says, giving thanks always for all things. It says the perpetual accompaniment of all these outlets of the Spirit in the Christian life is thanksgiving or gratitude. It's giving thanks, expressing appreciation to God for what he does for us. And our challenge as Christians is to be able to always remember God's blessing. Always remember his blessings, always remember his mercy, always remember what he's doing for us, the gift of the truth that he gives us, and the future that he has in store for us. Take a look at Philippians, Philippians 4, the next book in the New Testament. Philippians chapter 4. Let's take a look at what Paul said in verses 10 through 12. Philippians 4:10, he says, "But I rejoice in the Lord greatly. Now, that now at last your care for me has flourished again, though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. Now Paul, the background to this, Paul had received a gift from the members at Philippi when he was, Philippi when he was in prison. Maybe it was some food, maybe it was some warm clothes, maybe a blanket. We don't know, have no idea what it is. But Paul says, you know, I really wasn't dependent on receiving this for me to be content, for me to be grateful. I've learned that I can be grateful, I can be content no matter what state I'm in. I appreciate it. I'm happy to get this gift from you, whatever it was. But he said, I've learned to be grateful regardless of the circumstances. Let me put this into the context of my recent life. I think you all know I had 3 visits to an emergency room. Twice to one emergency room, one in California, twice to one here in East Texas, and a visit to an allergy specialist. And every one of them diagnosed it the same. Idiopathic angioedema. Idiopathic meaning, we have no idea. Don't ask me. Well, I'm asking you. We don't know. And the angioedema is the swelling of facial tissue and, you know, mouth, tongue, throat, lips. I had no idea. Eventually, we were able to determine that it was a histamine imbalance, and lots of foods contain high levels of histamine. Other foods block the working of DAO or block the production of DAO, which is an enzyme that helps lower your histamine levels. And there are other foods that release histamine that's already in your body. So you got 3 different things, and you've got all these foods and all these different categories, and my food choices kept getting narrower and narrower and narrower. What can I eat? You know? Well, it got to be less and less and less. Some foods do all 3, so anyway, somewhat limited. And when you're in that kind of situation, believe me, it's very easy to start looking at all this other stuff. And then go to the feast in Jamaica where you pay for your room and everything's included in the room. All the food you want to eat, there are all these food courts, you just go get whatever you want. It's all paid for. Don't worry about it, it's all paid for. You want to drink? Hey, that's all paid for too, no problem. And then to go, nope, can't have that. Not visiting the bars, I can go through the food line, but I got to be, even cheese, I can have, you know, 1 or 2 types of cheese, all the rest of that, nope. It's very easy to start looking at what you can't have instead of what you can have. I was blessed in that I was able to talk to the chef. First morning I had a little bit of swelling, and which was probably a good thing because he saw what it does to me, and told him I need some special food if you wouldn't mind. He said, oh, no, I'll take care of you. And so he cooked something for me every day that I could eat. Now, remember, this is the Caribbean, so it's island time. So I'm going to be at 12 o'clock, and we're going to be right there at 12 o'clock. And it wasn't always there at 12. In fact, I don't remember it ever being there at 12. So, you know, you wait, and maybe everybody's almost through eating before you get your food. But I could eat a few things off the line. And, you know, every now and then I'd find myself thinking, oh, you know, here's all this stuff, and I can't have it. Started focusing on what I couldn't have, and then, wait. He is going to bring me a plate. And he did. Every day for lunch and dinner, he brought me a plate of food that I could eat. But it's a constant battle, isn't it? It's this battle going on between the ears up here of get your attitude straight or let your mind run away with you and take you in the wrong direction. Now, I wish I could stand here and say, hey, I nailed it, man. Every time. Perfect. Kept my cool. Just kept myself under control. Oh, there are times when it started. Oh, man, this is so frustrating. Nope, wait. Would I rather start swelling? Or do I want to be patient and eat what I can eat? You see, that's the way our minds work. It's so easy for us to have the difficulty of letting ourselves focus on what we cannot eat. Seems I now have that cleared out of my system. I'm adding things back to eat, which I am very grateful for. But I hope I've learned the lesson. I hope I can remember this lesson. Look at and be grateful for what you do have. Don't focus on what you don't have. Yes, it's nice if you can eventually have that, but focus on what you do have. Our daughter, Cami, works with nutrition, helps people with special diets. She just posted a blog, I think it was yesterday, titled Thankful for What We Can Eat. She has a website about nutrition, and maybe it's because I just had gone through this, but it struck me as, boy, that's a wonderful, excellent blog. Focus on what you can, not on what you can't. You know, there are always things that we can be grateful for. The old saying, count your blessings. Sometimes you might have to write them down, but whatever it is, get it in your head. Be sure to express your gratitude to God. That's the gratitude attitude that Paul is describing here in Philippians 4. That's what he is talking about. And that's the challenge we all face in life. In whatever areas we're challenged in, or whatever areas of difficulty we face, then we may lose a battle here or there, but the point is, the Bible tells us, get up. Get up. Fight again. Win the next battle with God's help. Never, never, never give up. And God will be thrilled to give you a reward in his kingdom, to make you a part of his family. You see, in 2 Corinthians 10, we read of Paul describing what I just, or writing what I just described as that battle that takes place in our minds. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, it's this war that takes place between our ears. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3, he says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, they're not physical, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. That's where the real battle is. It's in our minds. It's in our attitude and our perspective, that we keep it in the right focus. We keep our focus in the right way. So how do we go about winning this mental battle to build this attitude of appreciation, of thankfulness, of gratitude? Well, that's a rather complex challenge, isn't it? For all of us, in many areas of life. Let me see if I can summarize this a little bit. I think a first step in this is to always recognize how complex it is. I mean, there are so many different areas where we can get discouraged or where we can get prideful. There are so many. If it were simple, there'd be one passage in the Bible we could turn to and say, here it is, do this, that'll solve it. But it doesn't work that way, does it? Human life is way too varied for there to be a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. We face a battle in this Christian warfare, and it's not just one battle, it's multiple battles. It's a warfare. That's what Paul describes us in, not just one battle. So here's what I would suggest we do to try to build that gratitude attitude. Practice, first of all, showing gratitude. Practice that. I think all of us could look at our lives and find a place, or several places perhaps, where we could do a better job of that, where we could do a little better job of showing appreciation. When we practice, it makes it easier for us to do the right thing under pressure when we find a time of difficulty. We practice in sports to gain muscle memory, whether it's dribbling or shooting a basketball, whether it's rolling a bowling ball down an alley trying to knock down all the pins, whether it's in volleyball, passing, you know, setting, spiking, whether it's catching a baseball or hitting a baseball. We practice in sports to build that muscle memory so that when we get in a game, we can repeat what we have learned, what we have practiced over and over again. So where's the practice field, spiritually speaking, for showing gratitude, to practice showing gratitude? Well, I would say basically we have two areas. One is physical, and the other is spiritual. In the physical area, I would say this. If we find it difficult to always think about positive things in the spiritual realm, start with the physical. What do we have that we can be thankful for? Look for ways to express our gratitude, even to other humans, to parents, coworkers, our husband, our wife, our children, grandchildren. Mr. Giese has directed the preteen camp in Texas, Camp Lone Star, for the past several years. And, of course, next year, Zach Smith is going to start, as Mr. Horchak mentioned, he's going to start directing that camp. So, in that sense, Mr. Giese was retiring from directing Camp Lone Star. So, as we typically do, I was talking to Mr. Horchak, well, we need to get a gift for him. We got to have a thank you card. We got to show our appreciation to him. And so we did that. We gave him a nice little gift card to a restaurant and a thank you card that all of the directors, all of the team had signed their names to. And Mr. Franks came in Tuesday morning and had a break in his schedule, was able to talk to us for a few minutes. And he picked up on that. And he said, you know, we often wait until somebody retires or until they quit, you know, doing something before we express our appreciation to them. And he said, that used to be the way it was. He said, I've tried to make it a point to thank people more, to show appreciation more as they're doing the job. He said, that's the thing we need to do. We need to be appreciating people and showing them that appreciation. We need to show our gratitude regularly. I was looking at Life Open Truth, looking up several articles, and of course there were links in this week's newsletter, LHT newsletter. One of them was, I think, was to this January-February 2019 issue of Discern. Becky Sweat wrote an article. I would encourage all of you to read the article. Maybe you did already. I thought it was a good article, How to Show Appreciation. You can search LHT to find it. But she had some good points, I thought, that she talked about. How that's part of God's unselfish nature to show appreciation, to express appreciation, to show gratitude. And she gave some points on that, you know, some of the value of gratitude. It helps others feel valuable. It inspires others to do well. It deepens bonds. It helps keeps us grounded in reality. It helps us stay positive and creates harmony within a group. You know, those are some of the main points she was making in that article. They're good points. And, of course, she talked about each of them. But showing gratitude is a benefit to the group, and it's a benefit to us individually, that it keeps us in the right frame of mind. And she goes on then to talk about how to show appreciation through words, body language, written notes, my service to other people. So, you know, you can read the article to get the details, but again, the point is practice showing appreciation to other people. It's a practice for the spiritual battlefield in our life. Now, from a spiritual perspective, the other one I would say is our prayer life. What do we talk about when we talk to God? How much of our prayer is about, or our prayer life is about, what we need, or what other, even other people, that's good to talk about what other people need. In a sense, that's asking God to intercede for others. But how much do we show gratitude and express our gratitude to God for what he's given us? How much do we focus on that? Our conversations with God, how much of those are sent exploring areas in our life where we can identify God's blessings? I think it was, who gave that sermon? Oh, it was Mr. Trotter. Several months back, he gave a sermon on little blessings. You know, the little blessings that we find in our life. Are we attuned to those? Do we recognize those? Do we express those to God? Do we express our appreciation for those? And do we express our gratitude for all kinds of things about his existence, his greatness, his mercy, his kindness, his calling, his truth, his plan of salvation, all of the wonderful things that he's explained to us, his church. You know, again, not to mention everyday life, every breath of air, life itself, all the physical things we are so bountifully blessed for in this country. How much of our prayer life is spent expressing those things? Again, why practice? Same reason we practice physical things, so that when we're faced with a difficulty, it'll be easier for us to do the right thing, to have that attitude of gratitude, as Paul wrote about in Philippians 4. Paul had learned, he said, to do that. It wasn't something that came automatically just because he had God's Holy Spirit. He learned it. He practiced it. And that helped him learn it. Again, there's no escaping the conclusion that God teaches us we are to be grateful, to be appreciative, to be thankful. And giving thanks is most often associated with prayer in people's minds. After all, it is a state of mind, and we're sharing what's on our mind when we're praying to God. The fact that we live in a time when many are focused on self, on getting for or loving or caring for themselves, being unthankful, in one sense is sort of a proof that we're in the end times, are close to them. But as I said, we could go back to Nebuchadnezzar. We can find examples in the Bible where other people were unthankful. I mean, there are any number of passages in the Bible. But I think it should also remind us that we need to be practicing that right frame of mind. Notice the instruction in Psalm 100. Psalm 100 is listed as a psalm of thanksgiving in the heading. Psalm 100. Beginning in verse 1, it says, "Make a joyful shout to the Lord, all you lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. Know that the Lord, he is God. It is he who has made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving and into his courts with praise. Be thankful to him and bless his name. For the Lord is good, his mercy is everlasting, and his truth endures to all generations." There, I read the whole chapter. Short one, isn't it? But a very important one. Talks about praising God, thanking God. Shout with gladness. Shout about his greatness. To serve him with gladness. To come with singing, with praise, with thanksgiving. My marginal note says, for all you lands, it says all the earth. All the earth, everybody should be praising God. It doesn't happen now. We know it will after Christ's return and Satan's put away. All of mankind will be able to learn about God's greatness and the wonderful things that he offers to mankind. Paul's instruction was the same as we read here in Psalm 100 in 2 Thessalonians 5. And we'll end with this passage in the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. So very short verses. And then a little bit longer verse in verse 18. So we'll start in verse 16. 1 Thessalonians 5. Verse 16, Paul is closing his first letter to the church in 1 Thessalonians 5. Verse 16, "Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ for you." Rejoice, pray, give thanks. We're told to do all these things continually. Always, regularly. So let's have a wonderful, meaningful Thanksgiving this week. But most importantly, let's learn to have a gratitude attitude all year long.